Hello, my name's David Emery, and this is For the Record program number 334, titled The Protocols of the Elders of Oil. This is being recorded on November 4th of the year 2001, and it's yet another broadcast in the series about the September 11th terrorist blitzkrieg, as I call it. This is a very complex event. I attribute the authorship of it to the Underground Reich, which is in and of itself a very complex concept. And I can only refer interested listeners to the other broadcasts in this series and background information in the many other broadcasts that I've produced. Those are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire that I'll tell you about later in the program. And the vast bulk of the For the Record programs are now available on Real Audio, either streaming and or available for download only on two websites run by sister station WFMU-FM. The title, The Protocols of the Elders of Oil, is a slight corruption of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an anti-Semitic tract that was one of the linchpins of Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism. And I am bringing this up because in the wake of the September 11th attacks, there has been an acceleration, of anti-Semitic rhetoric, not only in the United States, but elsewhere, attributing the attacks to Israel, to the Mossad, etc. And that is basically what we're going to be talking about this evening. Not anti-Semitism per se, but the role of oil. And petrofascism, to coin a term, is one of the central elements in the milieu that authored these events, in my opinion, as is Islamofascism. And I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but rather it is an extremist sect within Islam called Wahhabism that we've spoken about before, specifically promulgated by Saudi Arabia and the Bin Laden family that is one of the central elements in this. And it is not Islam, it is Islamofascist, and it is a sect in Islam that has a traditional association not only with international fascism, but also with, and particularly with, the petroleum industry. San Jose Mercury News, Monday, October 22nd of 2001, carried the following article by David Firestone of the New York Times. The Mercury headlined this, Jewish-Muslim Dialogue Falters, subtitled After September 11th, Bitter Disagreement About What is Terrorism. It reads in part, in the weeks since the September 11th attacks, a wide and increasingly bitter gulf has opened between many Jewish and Muslim leaders in this country over the nature of terrorism and the role played by Israeli policies in fomenting Muslim anger against the United States. In several cities across the country, rabbis and Jewish lay leaders have walked out of long-standing interfaith dialogues with Muslim leaders, complaining that the Muslims are condoning suicide bombing attacks against Israelis while condemning the attacks against the United States. Statements by some Muslim leaders that Israel may have been behind the World Trade Center attacks have led to angry denunciations by Jewish officials, endangering relationships that took years to construct. One of the probable reasons for this, aside from the fact that Israeli-Palestinian question is certainly something that is being utilized as an emotional distraction from the actual hard political and economic issues behind this, in particular, oil, the Saudi brand of Islamofascism, as a writer that I quoted in For the Record 329 called it, is being heavily promoted in this country. And again, that Islamofascist sect, so to speak, is called Wahhabism. It is peculiar to Saudi Arabia, is sort of native of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed Wahhab is a native of the city of Najd, N-E-J-D, which was, interestingly enough, actually forecast, predicted by the Prophet Muhammad to be a source of corruption and confusion in the future. Najd is now called Jeddah, and it is now the headquarters of the Bin Laden family. Wahhabism is being actively promoted in the United States by the Saudi government in Islamic congregations. An article about that appeared in the New York Times of Saturday, October 20th of the year 2001. This article is by Blaine Hardin, H-A-R-D-E-N. It's headlined, Saudis Seek to Add U.S. Muslims to Their Sect. It reads in part, in a costly and quietly insistent campaign to spread its state religion, Saudi Arabia has been trying for decades to induce American Muslims to become followers of the puritanical Islamic sect that sustains the power of the Saudi royal family. By building mosques across the country, sending Americans to the Middle East to be trained as imams, and promoting pilgrimages to Mecca, The Saudis have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in an effort to stamp their austere version of Islam on the lives of Muslims in the United States. That version is called Wahhabism, although the Saudis are loath to use the term in referring to their proselytizing in this country. As practiced in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism denies equal rights to women, and its teachings have inspired the violent extremism of Osama bin Laden and the Taliban government that harbors him in Afghanistan. And again, the entire situation vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinians is fodder for future broadcasts. Neither side is without blame. The fact of the matter is that it is the last unresolved displaced person situation from the Second World War. And to make a very long story very short, the anti-Semitism that is now becoming increasingly popular in the U.S. and in particular in the Muslim world is not only a distraction, but is frankly completely beside the point. Israel has no oil. The Islamic countries, including Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, does, in terms of population, that is. And when you filled up your gas tank last, did you put in A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? This is not hard to figure out. One of the spokespersons who has been very, very visible, in particular in the United States and in particular in more progressive political circles as a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause, and again, that whole issue is a separate issue, and the Palestinian National Movement has very strong links in international fascism and the Third Reich. The most extreme end of the Israeli right wing, including the Likud party, also has links going back to fascist Italy. I've spoken about both of those in many broadcasts in the past. The sort of darling of the progressive sector as a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause has been very visible recently in the United States. That's a woman named Hanan Ashrawi. First name, capital H-A-N-A-N, last name, capital A-S-H-R-A-W-I. An article about Ms. Ashrawi appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, November 4th of the year 2001. This is an article by Tyche, T-Y-C-H-E, Hendricks, and it's headlined, Palestinian Lawmaker Discusses Peace in San Francisco, subtitled, Process Hinges on Sovereignty, she says. It reads in part, on a visit to San Francisco, prominent Palestinian intellectual and human rights advocate Hanan Ashrawi said yesterday that ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories is the only route to peace in the Middle East and possibly a key step in the U.S. fight against terrorism. Ashrawi, an elected member of the Palestinian Legislative Council and a spokeswoman for the Arab League, said in an interview with the Chronicle that she is encouraged to see President Bush taking a tougher stance with Israel in recent weeks after a hands-off approach in the early months of his administration. Well, Hanan Ashrawi has a different background from one that might be supposed, in particular by some of the progressive elements that have been promoting her situation. That's discussed in a very important but most unfortunately titled book that I've used many times in the past called The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former Justice Department investigator and military officer John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. This is an approximately 500-page book with 135 or so pages of footnotes and relies heavily on a group of former U.S., British, and Soviet intelligence operatives whom the authors refer to as the old spies because, provided that they had anonymity, they were allowed to publish their stories by the CIA. John Loftus had power of attorney for these agents. And it should be noted for those who would generalize about the national security establishment, there are, quote, good, unquote, factions of the CIA, as with the FBI and the military. The people behind this book are one of those, not Loftus necessarily, but the element of the CIA that okayed this is one of those, and it's sad that people have not used this book. Now, Hanan Ashrawi, along with other, quote, moderate, unquote, Palestinian leaders, were brought to the United States under the auspices of former Secretary of State under George Bush, James Baker, and they were tutored by the Central Intelligence Agency in the latest public relations techniques. The agency dubbed these leaders Baker's Dozen, and John Loftus and Mark Ahrens write about them as follows. The CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, included most of the official, unquote, Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Hanan Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saeed Erekat, Sari Nusseibeh, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a three-day conference on integrating their politics with the U.S. Ashrawi was singled out as a good Palestinian image spokeswoman, dubbed by the company the Palestinian Golda Meir, unquote. The Israelis did not know that part of the PLO was being funded and trained by the CIA at the same time that the agency was pretending to work with Israel against the PLO. Arafat himself wasn't crazy about the situation. He was getting squeezed on the right by the CIA's assets and on the left by the Syrian-controlled radicals. Of course, the CIA's agents among the Palestinians had to look like radicals, too. Quote, one of the PLO leaders argued that unless his fighters were allowed to commit some actions against Israel, they would not be taken seriously. The CIA encouraged attacks on non-civilian targets. Military targets, Sha'ar Victor, army camps, and immigration centers, the sole exception to the non-civilian target. At this point, the deputy director of operations thought the operations were going too far and threatened to resign, unquote. How could the U.S. government arm some terrorists and hunt others? One of our sources explained the contradiction. You see, Abu Nidal was a terrorist because he killed Americans. Arafat was a freedom fighter because he only killed Jews. And again, we don't have time to discuss the entire Israeli-Palestinian question, to put it mildly. We don't even have time to go over all of the aspects of the September 11th broadcast. But by way of making a transition from the discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian issue to what really underlies politics in the Middle East, namely what the Texans refer to as the business, let's take a look at the front page of the New York Times for Wednesday, July 26th of the year 2000. A very, very interesting juxtaposition of events, and I don't believe this is in any way coincidental, can be found in the first two stories, the two most important stories, again, on the front page of the New York Times, Wednesday, July 26th of the year 2000. Bearing in mind that Hanan Ashrawi, coached by the CIA in the latest PR techniques, and a protege of James Baker, one of Baker's Dozen, as the agency referred to them, was part of the Palestinian negotiating team. The lead story of the New York Times on 7/26/2000 is by Jane Perlez. It's headlined, Clinton Ends Deadlocked Peace Talks, and it reads in part, at the end of 2 weeks of marathon negotiations with the leaders of Israel and the Palestinians, a visibly fatigued President Clinton announced today that they were unable to reach an agreement, quote, at this time, unquote. The president and other American mediators made clear that it was Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, who balked in the end, and by all accounts, the issue was Jerusalem, the holy city both Israelis and Palestinians claim as their sacred capital. Yasser Arafat walking out of the, out of the Camp David talks. And on the other side of the front page of the New York Times of 7/26, the reason why, I suspect, can be clearly discerned. The second most important story of the New York Times on the front page of that same day, Bush names Cheney, citing integrity and experience, unquote. This is by Frank Bruni, or Bruni, B-R-U-N-I, Dateline Austin, Texas. It reads in part, Governor George W. Bush formally introduced his running mate, Dick Cheney, to a cheering crowd here today, praising the former defense secretary and longtime family friend as a man of great integrity, sound judgment, and experience, unquote. As Mr. Cheney stood almost bashfully at the side of the ebullient Texas governor, Mr. Bush tacitly acknowledged the oddity of this months-long search for a vice presidential nominee, ending with the selection of the searcher himself. Mr. Cheney had been tapped by Mr. Bush to supervise that process in late April. Of course, Dick Cheney, the former CEO of Halliburton Oil, the largest oil field exploration company in the world, is, like George Bush and like White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card is a lobbyist for the automobile industry. Like so many people in the Bush administration, is either affiliated with the petroleum industry or the energy industry. The Secretary of Commerce, whose name escapes me right off the top of my head, is also involved with the oil industry. The entire Bush administration, as I've spoken about many times in the past, in For the Record programs about the, quote, energy crisis, is inextricably linked with the petroleum industry. And I do not think it is a coincidence at all that the day that George Bush named Dick Cheney to be his vice presidential candidate, thus having basically a petroleum candidacy on the side of the Republicans, I suspect that had much to do with Yasser Arafat's decision to cease cooperation with the peace process, because basically underlying all of the power politics in that part of the world is not religion, but oil. Religion is the distraction. And in particular, the largest oil exporting country in the world is Saudi Arabia, with 25% of the world's proven oil reserves. Now, the coincidence of the conclusion of the unsuccessful termination of the Camp David peace negotiations with Dick Cheney, again a Bush 1 administration official and an oil man to be Dick Cheney's to be George Bush's running mate. I believe that Arafat and the petroleum interests who are behind, from a financial standpoint, the Palestinian National Movement, that it gets a lot of capital from Saudi Arabia, and the profoundly unjust social conditions that obtain in the vast majority of not only the Middle Eastern Arab countries, Middle Eastern Muslim countries, but also Muslim countries in other parts of the world, such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Indonesia. The Palestinian-Israeli question is essentially a red herring and a scapegoat. It has nothing to do with the conditions that exist in those countries. They would be the same even if Israel didn't exist, and there the abject misery that those people live in has other causes, not Israel. We're going to take a look now at another element of what I call movement, and again, I believe the nomination of oil man Dick Cheney to be oil man George Bush's vice presidential candidate, and the conclusion of the peace talks by Yasser Arafat and part of his negotiating team being a baker's dozen, including Hanan Ashrawi. That, I believe, was not a coincidence, nor do I believe the following is a coincidence. In For the Record program number 330, we looked at some interesting changes that had taken place vis-a-vis the Saudi Arabian government, and in a New York Times story that was quoted in the San Francisco Chronicle, I noted in For the Record 330 that the Saudis had changed intelligence chiefs in what was described as last summer, meaning the summer of 2001. In fact, the time frame was much, much closer than that, more interesting, I should say. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Washington Post of September 9th, 2001. This is an op-ed column by Jim Hoagland, H-O-A-G-L-A-N-D. It's called Status Quo in the Persian Gulf. And again, this ran 2 days before the September 11th attacks. This is from 9-9. Skipping down, we read, when Saudi Arabia's intelligence chief was dumped last week, and a prince a generation older named as his successor, Washington's Middle East analyst speculated furiously about how it changed succession and power balances in the royal family. A series of unusually high-profile public warnings of a regional explosion came from the normally somber foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal, and added to the sense here that something is stirring in the desert kingdom. So the week before the attacks on September 11th, Saudi Arabia changes intelligence chiefs, and their foreign minister warns of an explosion. In For the Record program 331, we noted an article from the Financial Times that 10 days before the September 11th attacks, Saudi Arabia indicated to the Bush administration that its stance on Israel and the Palestinian question was unacceptable. And I would note that Hanan Ashrawi, one of Baker's dozen, the CIA put it, has been echoing similar themes here in the United States. More movement, this in the most, what I call movement, this in the most literal sense. We're going to take a look now at the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, October 29th of the year 2001. This is an op-ed column by Thomas Friedman. This is from the New York Times service and syndicated service. The Chronicle headlined this op-ed column, U.S. is really alone in this war. It reads in part as follows, skipping down. The Saudi ruling family would love to quit. This is, by the way, Thomas Friedman is being sarcastic here. The Saudi ruling family would love to cooperate by handing over its police files on the 15 Saudis involved in the hijackings, but that would be a violation of their sovereignty. And, well, you know how much the Saudis respect sovereignty. Like when the Saudi embassy in Washington rushed all of Osama bin Laden's relatives out of America after September 11th on a private Saudi jet before they could be properly questioned by the FBI. We're going to talk about the bin Laden family in the United States in numerous For the Record programs. We've discussed the business connections between George W. and the North American business representative for the bin Laden family, James R. Bath, who, possibly acting as a direct financial conduit from the bin Laden family, helped to capitalize George W.'s first oil company. We have also spoken about the connections between the elder George Bush, the business connections, that is, between the elder George Bush and the bin Laden family. In For the Record program 329, we detailed the business connections between the Carlyle Group, a very prestigious and wealthy investment firm for which the elder George Bush works, and the bin Laden family, which helped to capitalize that. Once again, an element of what I call movement. This is from the New York Times of Friday, October 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Kurt Eichenwald. It's datelined Washington, October 25th, and headlined, Bin Laden Family Liquidates Holdings with Carlyle Group, and it reads in part as follows. The Saudi family of Osama bin Laden is severing its financial ties with the Carlyle Group, a private investment firm known for its connections to influential Washington political figures, executives who have been briefed on the decision, said today. The decision, reached late last week, was by mutual agreement, a senior executive with the investment firm said. It came largely as a result of public controversy about the family's stake in a Carlyle fund that invests in buyouts of military and aerospace companies, the executive said. After the September 11th attacks, the investment was criticized amid speculation that the family might profit from increased military spending from America's war on terrorism. I would add, parenthetically, one wonders if perhaps there are any connections between some of those bought-out companies and some of the shenanigans that have been taking place worldwide. More about that speculative line of inquiry later in the program. Skipping down, speaking of the bin Laden family, the majority of the family's net worth comes from its primary company, the Saudi bin Laden Group, one of the most prominent construction companies in the Middle East. But the family also invests around the globe with an array of funds and financial institutions, including several in the United States. The Carlyle investments in question are among those. That financial and regional influence has won the family and its business an array of prominent visitors from the United States. Trips for American businesses arranged by the U.S. Saudi Arabian Business Council, a Washington trade organization, often feature visits with the Saudi bin Laden Group. In recent years, Frank C. Carlucci, the chairman of Carlyle and a former Secretary of Defense, has visited the family's headquarters in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, as have former President George Bush and James A. Baker III, the former Secretary of State. Mr. Bush works as an advisor to Carlyle, and Mr. Baker is a partner in the firm. Again, Hanan Ashrawi, a protege of James Baker, one of Baker's dozen coached by the CIA in the latest PR techniques. A very, very informative article, albeit one that is heavily spun, so to speak, appeared in the New York Times on Sunday, October 28th of the year 2001. This is an article about the bin Laden family's geographical operations, so to speak, and their business connections. This is an article that we will probably be finishing on the other side, in the other side of this program. However, I'm going to talk about part of it right now. This article is headlined by the New York Times of 10/28/2001, Bin Laden Family with Deep Western Ties strives to reestablish a name, co-authored by Allison Lee Cowan, Kurt Eichenwald, and Michael Moss. Skipping down, we read, after talking about the September 11th attacks and the problems this had caused the bin Laden family from a PR standpoint, it is the family of both a terrorist bent on destroying Western influence in the Middle East and the owner of the Saudi bin Laden Group, a corporate giant with tens of thousands of employees in business dealings with companies like General Electric and Motorola. The company uses a different transliteration of the Arabic name from the usual Western Bin Laden. According to American business executives, family members do business with an array of financial institutions, including Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Deutsche Bank. Until earlier this month, the family also had a stake in the Carlyle Group, a Washington investment firm with ties to the luminaries in politics. Skipping down. Others are sticking with them, citing American officials who say they have no evidence of financial links between the family and Osama bin Laden. By the way, that is BS, as we'll see in a minute. Quote, "We've talked to the State Department, and so far as we can tell, these people are clean," said Steven Seiler, chief executive of Hybridon, a biotechnology company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in which a bin Laden brother has a small stake. Parenthetically, and I would ask, this is a question, not a statement, one wonders if they have anything to do with the making of anthrax spores or any other sort of biological warfare agent, or whether this could be dual-use technology. Again, a question I'm asking. Skipping down. In the days after September 11th, the bin Ladens in America left for Saudi Arabia with the assistance of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, Saudi Arabia's ambassador in Washington. Now, people who have been in contact with the family said they are working to devise a public relations strategy with his numerous half-brothers. And again, that departure was before they could be questioned by the FBI. Reviewing an element that we looked at in For the Record program number 330, skipping down again, the bin Ladens must reach a consensus before taking any action. One question they may face is the family's position toward Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, a man who has been identified as Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law and who has been accused by law enforcement officials in the Philippines of having funneled money to Islamic militants. Mr. Khalifa has denied the allegation. We're going to finish excerpting this article and analyzing some key parts of it in the second half of For the Record program number 334. Now, I've made allusions to other broadcasts on various subjects from the Middle Eastern question, the fascist heritage of the Palestinian National Movement and of the Israeli right wing, as well as many of the other background elements for this very, very complicated and long-running discussion. Those programs are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Again, Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. And you can visit the Spitfire website, which is equipped with real audio featuring the broadcasts going out to the stations that carry this program each week, and featuring not only description, not only a list of the programs available, but also descriptions of most of the programs. There are long descriptions of the For the Record programs. They have been footnoted since June of the year 2000. By the way, due to the huge volume of material, I am somewhat behind in writing descriptions, and Spitfire is somewhat behind in getting some of those I have written up on the website. They will be available, so if this admittedly fast presentation is sort of overwhelming, people can check the Spitfire website and get a synoptic account of each point of information and the source. That website is at www.spitfirelist.com. And again, Spitfire List is one word. There are links between the Spitfire website on the For the Record section and two websites that are operated by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent programs are streaming at the WFMU website, www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, DaveEmory. There are also links between the WFMU.org/Dave Emory website and a longer URL, which has the vast majority of the For the Record programs available for download only on real audio. Both of the WFMU sites are linked to the Spitfire website as well. This concludes For the Record program number 334, Side A, The Protocols of the Elders of Oil. This is being recorded on November 4th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.